At 26 minutes after the hour, since it's a Thursday, Pastor Robbie has dropped in, and we want to turn our attention to him because we're about to learn something. Well, I'm about to learn something. I guess I can't speak for everybody. Pastor Robbie is an Anglican pastor based in Ashburn, Virginia. He's also the executive director of Preserving Bible Times, and Robbie has become just a great friend of the station over, what, 2 years now? 3 years?
Yeah, I think it is, a little bit over 2 years.
Wow. We must be having fun because time is flying. Yeah,
it is. Time flies when you're having fun. Always a joy to be with you, Jim and David, on the Broken Road. It's a pleasure as always.
Well, I made a mistake coming on the air. I greeted everybody on All Saints Day here, and I had to explain to David, yes, it was my mistake, but I thought today was November 1st. I mean, that was the mistake. Yeah. Not it would have been right, but if it were really November 1st.
Well, but I got to tell you got reason to be confused. I mean, you know, All Souls Day has been conflated into All Saints Day. Not everyone is observing both. So
yeah, today is the second is All Souls Day, and I have no idea. This is the first I've heard of that.
Yeah, me too. I'm normally, you know, I grew up Protestant. I grew up Southern Baptist, and well, I guess I'm still Protestant. I'm Anglican, but it's more Catholic or liturgical in its expression. So we have specific feast days which commemorate certain saints in the Anglican Church. The Roman Catholic Church does that as well. But
that was my other misconception. To me, All Saints Day originated with the Roman Catholic Church and probably referred to those people whom they have designated specifically as saints for the kind of life they led. But now I'm learning it's bigger than that, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So any saint who is someone who has died in the Lord, is how we say it, or died having a relationship with God through his son, Jesus Christ, someone who is in heaven is a saint. So my father passed away when I was 22. He was 52. He went to be with the Lord. I love John. And 1 John says, "Beloved, it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when we see him, we will be like him, for we shall see him as he is." So this idea that when we are on the other side of eternity, we see Jesus and we become like him because we see him fully. Paul says it this way in 2 Corinthians 5:8. He says, "We're confident, I say, and willing rather, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord." So this idea that once we die, we transition from this life to the next, and we are saints in glory. All those who have died and are in heaven are saints. Now, certainly there are specific church fathers who have died who are sainted, and there are certain days where we celebrate specific saints in the liturgical year. And so those are feast days, and usually the color in the liturgical calendar, we have these liturgical calendars that are color-coded, and the feast days are in white. And so those specific saint days are feast days. So an example in the Anglican Church, this wouldn't be an example of a Catholic saint, but on the 29th of November, we remember C.S. Lewis. And we remember him specifically because he was an Anglican believer who is dead in the Lord. So
I'm reading a quote from him by now. We have a slide on our website. "There are no ordinary people," C.S. Lewis writes, "you have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations are mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit, immortal horrors or everlasting splendors." So talking about the spiritual, I mean, that pretty well nails it. We are all immortals, but not all saints.
Yeah. C.S. Lewis is also attributed to say we've never met a mere mortal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that we're all eternal beings. And this is the misconception around the resurrection. A lot of people believe that, you know, you're either resurrected to heaven or that's it. But really, everyone gets resurrected, the believer and the unbeliever alike. The believer into the presence of God in heaven, and the unbeliever into eternal judgment, to never die, but to live in eternal torment. We don't like to talk about that. because that's, you know, hell, and no one wants to think or consider that. I mean, a lot of people think that we're living hell now. We're living like an eternal, or, you know, we're living in this world, and this world is judgment, or this world is hell, and to die would be to escape this world, and everybody experiences the same fate. We don't believe that as Christians, certainly. We believe in a resurrection for the believer and the unbeliever alike, the believer to heaven, the unbeliever to eternal damnation. And I would cite, by the way, Luke on that, because if you look at the rich, it's not a parable. It doesn't say it's a parable, but the rich, the account of the rich man and Lazarus, you get a clear picture of that.
Well, in that picture, though, here is Lazarus in heaven with Moses, and he's staring across a chasm of some kind. This is maybe a tough question, but is that a literal chasm or a figurative chasm? What represents distance in the spiritual world? And that also brings to mind Revelation, where supposedly there's a new heaven, a new earth, that we are made in to be residents of earth in that new heaven. But outside the fence, outside the gates, it seems there's evil still. So is there still some recognition of evil or awareness of evil, the presence of evil in heaven? I'm a little confused on that.
Yeah, I don't think there's any presence of evil in the new Jerusalem, the new heaven, new earth. And that's why the separation actually has to exist. And the first time you see this separation, by the way, is Genesis. It's at the fall in the garden when the cherubim and seraphim are put in the garden with the flaming swords, and Adam and Eve are banished east of Eden. I mean, that's the first time you see humanity being distanced from God. And notice that humanity leaves God, and therefore they are distanced. God does not leave humanity. It's been said that hell is the absence of God. That's one of my favorite definitions of hell. Not so much. I mean, I also believe it's a place. I believe it's a place of eternal judgment. The Bible describes it as a place of fire. Revelation talks about the lake of fire. But Revelation also talks about heaven as being a place where there's no more sadness, no more evil, no more war. So if there is no more potential for sin, no more evil, no more temptation, the evil one and his, you know, the devil and his demons and minions are gone. There's no more potential for any sadness or any sin or any evil in heaven. And that's what by definition makes it heaven. And I want to be there. And so the rich man and Lazarus, when Jesus tells this account, it's not prefaced with, hey, let me tell you a story. And here it's referred to as Abraham's bosom. So we've got this rich man, we've got Lazarus.
I'm sorry, yeah, he was with Abraham, not Moses.
Yeah, yeah. And so all of this is in Luke 16. So Luke 16, 19 through 31, and it's Abraham's side, so where Abraham is. And, you know, when I read this, I think about Jesus' words, because Jesus said this about Abraham. He said, before Abraham was, I am. And he said something else that was peculiar. He said, Abraham rejoiced to see my day and was glad in it. So you get this picture of Jesus hanging out with Abraham from the account of Jesus's own words. I mean, Jesus had to be in the presence of Abraham. Abraham had to be in the presence of Jesus for Jesus to know and see that Abraham rejoiced to see his day and was glad in it. So you get this impression that Abraham's there, and you've got Lazarus with Abraham, and the rich man's he's dead, he's buried. So we see, and this is another thing that I think is important for us to wrestle with. When we die, our bodies go in the ground, or they go to the earth. They go to dust. We say this in Lent, Ash Wednesday, which begins Lent, we say, remember that you are dust, and to dust you shall return. It's God's words to humanity at the fall. So we see the rich man's body buried. And Lazarus is dead and buried. We will assume that he's buried. Here we see that the rich man is buried. This is verse 22. It says it. And in Hades, where he, the rich man, was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away. So this is, to your point, this distance, this far awayness, this separation. And Lazarus is by the side of Abraham. So he called to him, "Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the finger of water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire." So here we see absent from the body is to be present, well, here in Abraham's bosom. I'm assuming that this is heaven here because of Paul's words, absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. Mm-hmm. Or let's just cite Jesus's words to the thief on the cross. "Today you will be with me in paradise," right? So clearly you've got this idea that we, though we die, yet shall we live. And this comes from Romans when Paul says it is appointed for a person to die once and then the resurrection.
Okay, question. What's the Anglican view of purgatory?
Purgatory does not exist.
Uh-huh.
There is no waiting room. And if you've ever been in a waiting room waiting for your doctor to call your name, or the DMV for crying out loud, you will know that purgatory is just hell, right? A waiting room
Good
is
point.
Just hell, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, you know, you shouldn't laugh about that, but, you know, got to laugh to keep from crying. I mean, judgment is real, and to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord for the believer, which means absent from the body for the unbeliever is to be present in eternal damnation or separation. So again, Paul says this, we see it again in Hebrews 9:27, as it is appointed to men once to die, but after this, the judgment. Well, for the believer, it's not guilty. And that's not because of our righteousness, but it's because of God's righteousness. So that's Hebrews. And so purgatory is seen, you know, some people interpret the rich man and Lazarus as purgatory, that Abraham's bosom is somehow purgatory, that the place of the dead in the Old Testament is where all the Old Testament saints are kind of lingering, awaiting the resurrection.
And that's referred to as Sheol? Does that refer?
Or, Sheol, yeah, or the place of the dead, or Abraham's bosom. And sometimes people pick these apart, and sometimes they conflate them as being the same. But it's appointed for man to die once, and then the resurrection, and or then the judgment, according to Hebrews 9:27.
So Jesus' reference to paradise was not to some place other than heaven, but to heaven itself. And I'm wondering if there's a translation issue there.
Yeah, you know. That's what I hold to. Now, what we're talking about, if we want to get fancy about it, is we're talking about eschatology, the study of the end of things, the study of the end of times. But to talk about the end, you can't, you know, a lot of people say, well, there's no resurrection until Jesus's death, burial, and resurrection. Well, what do you do with the rich man and Lazarus? Because this is an account that Jesus is telling. And I think it's very telling because we see the separation, we see the judgment. And what's also peculiar here is the rich man wants Lazarus to dip his finger in water and to cool his tongue, because he says, "I'm in an agony of fire." This is verse 24. But Abraham tells him, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received good things while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted and here you are in agony. And besides all this, between you and him," here it is again, "is a great chasm has been set in place so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us." So if you want to study the end of times and label this as some sort of pre-resurrection waiting room, then what do you do with the idea that Abraham just said that nobody's crossing these boundaries?
Mm-hmm.
So you can't say, well, at the resurrection, now Lazarus leaves and goes to heaven. Because it says that Lazarus can't leave this place, neither can you leave this place and go to him. He can't leave and come to you. So if that's been set in place, then there you have it.
I'm still debating here internally as to whether it's parable or actual event. And you say it's an actual event that he's describing.
Yeah.
There are other places where Jesus refers to things that go on in heaven. For example, children have angels who speak to God about them. I may have misstated that, but he's talking about children when his disciples were keeping them from him. But he says they have angels that speak to God essentially on their behalf every day. Is that that's not parable,
right? Well, here's the confusion. There are some Bibles that have a chapter heading that says the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, but this has no indication that there is a parable being told here. As a matter of fact, verse 19 just begins with, there was a rich man who was dressed in purple. So it's not, let me tell you a story, or then he spoke to them in parables. There's no indication that this is a parable.
Does it appear in any place other than Luke?
It's just Luke's gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unique to Luke's gospel. And to your point, Moses is mentioned in the parable. He said to him, if they did not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced if someone rises from the dead. And so this is how the account ends. And so there's this whole conversation between the rich man and Abraham. And apparently what's interesting is that they're seeing into one another's position, but they can't cross over. And that there's this conversation that's happening between the rich man and Abraham.
Another angle on this is that the rich man has a longing to communicate, to feel the presence of Lazarus from the other side. So he knows there's another side. He's aware of there being heaven. And that would be like being in hell, knowing that,
yeah,
that there's a loving God and you have no access to him anymore.
Watching the live feed of the greatest party ever with the greatest host ever, and know you're not invited and can't join in.
The door, you know, door is closed.
Yeah, it's like sitting in a waiting room somewhere watching a film of everybody else having fun and you're not. You know, you heard of FOMO, fear of missing out.
Mm-hmm.
And this is that. And so the rich man answers, he says, I beg of you, Father, send Lazarus to my family. In other words, at least let him go warn my family. I have five brothers. Let him warn them so that they will not also come to this place. And he labels it, come to this place of torment. This is verse 28 of Luke 16. Abraham replied, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them. No, Father Abraham, he said, but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent. And this kind of invokes what we know happens in Peter, that Jesus goes and preaches to those who are in torment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something else I've never understood. Where did he go?
Right. And there's a big debate, because it does say in the time of Noah. And so you see this in 1 Peter 3, verses 18 through 20. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God. Being put to death in the flesh, he made us alive in the spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison. Now, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, this idea that if we leave our bodies on this side of eternity, we are resurrected in a spiritual body of some sort. And you can, and I'll cite 1 Corinthians 15 for the different bodies. And Paul lays out the different embodiments of the spiritual body and the physical body And then in verse 20, Peter says, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through the water. Now, certainly, all the people who died in judgment in Genesis 9 in the days of Noah, I mean, Jesus went and preached to those who were in prison. Did that also include everyone who's died and gone to judgment from Noah until the death of Jesus?
That's what I've always assumed in that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
But it doesn't say that, which is perplexing.
Well, here's a collateral question, and this has to do with the Hebrew view of spirit. And I remember some of Doug's teachings on this, too. And he maintained that the Hebrew people were very physical. That's what you do. It's tangible. And their notions of heaven, for example, are a little bit vague. I don't remember how often heaven might be mentioned in the Old Testament, but do you have you studied that? What this transition to what we call the New Testament? I mean, the whole feel of the literature is radically different from the Old Testament, and yet there are so many ties between the two. Mm-hmm. Do you know of any Hebrew references in the Old Testament to heaven as it's referred to in the New Testament?
Well, again, it's often referred to as Abraham's bosom. So you've got judgment, you've got Abraham's bosom, but then again, we made this case last week, I mean, between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. I mean, you have Jewish people at the in the text. When we're looking at the Gospels, Christianity doesn't exist until Jesus's death, burial, resurrection, and ascension in terms of the way that we know it. People are Jewish or they're Gentile, and the Jewish people are wrestling with is there a resurrection. And so we see this with the Sadducees, and we pointed this out last week, who, comma, don't believe in the resurrection, comma. And that's in Matthew's text as a descriptor of the Sadducees. The Sadducees are Jewish people who are rooted in the Jewish faith who do not believe in a resurrection.
Were Sadducees also Pharisees, or was that a separate political entity? Because from historical times, back to the Maccabees and how the Pharisees came into being as a political party, it seems almost like the Sadducees were a throwback to the Old Testament, whereas the Pharisees were a bit more enlightened, still wrong by Jesus' own estimate and description. He spoke in opposition to both the Pharisees and the Sadducees. But that gulf between Sadducees and Pharisees, it Paul was sensitive to it. In fact, he took advantage of it, defending himself in court. Sadducees, Old Testament people?
I mean, I don't know. We do see them in the first century in the Gospels and in the Second Temple period. So we see them, and we see the Pharisees and the Essenes. Josephus speaks about them in his writings. So at the end of the first century, Josephus is writing about them. So we can assume, as you know, the gospel writers are recording these groups of people, that this is a carryover from Second Temple Judaism and the resettling of the land after the exile in Babylon, that these groups are existing.
The Sadducees come to Jesus and they ask him about whose husband.
Yeah.
Who's, and they're talking about an afterlife. This must have been sarcasm on their part.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That account of Jesus being trapped by the Sadducees and in Matthew's gospel, they are being very sarcastic, and they're trying to trap Jesus in thinking about the resurrection. It's like, okay, bud, you believe in the resurrection. Let me throw the complexity of your theology back at you, because if the resurrection is a thing, what do you do with marriage, which is supposed to be eternal? And so the Sadducees, you know, part of it is sarcasm, But I also think that part of it is a genuine question. So you see this in Matthew 22.
This may have been something they had debated with the Pharisees.
Of course. Yeah. So Sadducees ask about the resurrection. I mean, everybody's debating. I mean, what do they say? If you have three rabbis in a room, you have four opinions. Mm. I mean, this is what they're sitting around doing in the portico of Solomon. They're wondering what the law means. They're kicking around theology. I mean, they do this stuff for fun. I mean, they kind of like us on a Thursday morning. We've got nothing better to do but talk about theology. I mean, they've been doing that for millennia. So the same day the Sadducees come to him who say there is no resurrection, this is Matthew 22, verse 23. And they ask him a question. And they say, Moses said if a man dies having no children, and they set it up, you know, and that the brother can marry to give an heir in the name of the brother. And this woman keeps going through brothers. I mean, she's got seven brothers. I mean, it's pretty preposterous. So they want to know whose wife this is going to be in the resurrection.
Yeah, how consistent is the law, the principle that you're right. You're espousing here, Jesus? Yeah.
The moral of the story: don't marry this woman. I mean, but marriage is a metaphor, and it's a living. Not I wouldn't say a metaphor. I think it's more like a living parable. Marriage is a living parable. Which God allows us to be in, and at the end, we are ultimately married to Christ. We are his bride, the church. Paul clearly talks about this in Corinthians, and he is our husband. He's the head of the church. And so when John talks about the resurrection, there's several accounts. Number one, chapter 7 of John, where the curtain is pulled back and John gets to see a multitude of every race, nation worshiping in the afterlife. And John's like, who are these people whose robes are white? And he says, you know them. These are the ones who have died and gone before. This is Revelation 7. And then at the end of Revelation, we see a new heaven and a new earth coming down like a bride adorned for her husband. So that imagery is that of a wedding imagery, and this is exactly what Jesus is trying to say to the, or is saying. He's not trying. He says it to them, that there's no one being married or given in marriage in heaven, because you don't need the metaphor or the parable, the living parable anymore. You've got the true wedding feast. You've got the true ultimate union between God and man. Now, so you don't need the earthly parable anymore.
Okay, so let's back to the beginning here. All Saints Day and All Souls Day.
Yeah.
What do you do on All Saints Day? Is it a commemoration, a celebration? Is it prayer? Is it all the above? And how does it differ from All Souls Day, which falls on today, this date?
Well, traditionally, and again, the Orthodox and the Catholics traditionally celebrate All Saints Day.
And by when you say Orthodox, the Eastern Orthodox Church.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the All Saints Day is remembering all the people who have died in the Lord who have gone before us. And I love my wife is Polish, and when we visit Poland, one of the things we do is we go to the grave sites of her family, and we wash the tombs, and we put fresh flowers, and we light candles. And these are Roman Catholic cemeteries, because if you're most Christians in Poland are Catholic. And so the Eastern Orthodox and the Roman Catholics remember that all the saints that have gone before. Now, All Souls Day is usually reserved for those who had been martyred and is currently most of the time being conflated or integrated with All Saints Day, which we observe on November the 1st. Now, All Souls Eve or the Eve of All Saints, All Hallows Eve, is the secular holiday of Halloween. In the Roman Catholic Church, and especially in Poland, people will go at midnight on All Saints Eve, All Hallows Eve, and they will clean these tombs. They will put out candles. And the cemeteries at night are ablaze with fresh candles. It's beautiful. and we remember our loved ones who have gone before us. Now, I do that. One of the things that I do when I go to my hometown is I will visit my family's cemeteries. My father's in the upcountry, upstate, near Anderson and Honeyapath. And then my mother's side of the family is in Fairfax near Allendale and Augusta, Georgia. And so I will go and visit these family members who have died. I'll weed the graves. I'll wash the tombstones. I'll put out some fresh flowers, and I'll remember them. It just so happens that on All Saints, this particular day is when everyone is doing this particular activity and remembering those saints who have gone before. Now, it used to be that this was celebrated or observed around Easter time, which would also be appropriate because, remember, we're not wallowing in the death of our loved ones. We're rejoicing in the resurrection of our loved ones. And we are a people of resurrection as followers of Jesus. So we remember that we don't die, we transition. We do die, but that is leaving this side of eternity for the next side of eternity. We live forever. We all live forever, either in heaven or we live forever into eternal judgment. So the commemoration of all faithful departed is All Saints and All Souls Day.
Interesting. And then and then there's this thing about going back and celebrating all these, but you don't know. You may have known them. You may have never known your ancestors. You're making the assumption, maybe you have the hope that they are in heaven.
Yeah. I just saw a meme recently of Morpheus from The Matrix, and he's got his sunglasses on, and he says, "What if I told you that the Catholic Church on the other side is larger than the Catholic Church here?" And that's right. What if I told you that there are more believers in heaven than exist on earth today, or close to it? Pretty amazing thought that those saints who have gone. I had this experience when I buried my grandfather. I was worried to death when I buried my grandfather that there wouldn't be anybody at his funeral. And the reason I worried about this is because he died at 96 years old. And I was bemoaning the fact that I wanted to celebrate his life and a life well lived, you know, a life of 65, 70 years in ministry. And at the vigil, or the visitation is what we call it in the Baptist church, the line for people to come visit my grandfather was out the door. And I couldn't figure it out. But it was families. It was whole families that he had married who had kids and grew up in our church.
Oh, my goodness. What a testimony. What a testimony.
And the other thing I was realizing is it didn't matter how many people showed up to the visitation before the funeral, because his homecoming on the other side of eternity was larger than his send-off this side of eternity. Because when I grew up in his little church, I remember from the time I was six going to funeral after funeral after funeral. He would take me along. We would visit the funeral homes before the funeral to view the bodies before the funeral. And I remember this as early as 6 years old and 7 years old.
Yeah.
And that man outlived all of his friend, or all of his friends and most of his church. And he had a receiving line on the other side of eternity that even outnumbered the line that went around the funeral home when we put him in the ground. And that's what we remember in All Saints. We remember all those saints who have gone before us.
That's a beautiful thing. Thank you for that explanation, that special stuff. Robbie, again, an Anglican pastor, has a church in Fairfax, Virginia, lives in Ashburn. He's also the executive director of Preserving Bible Times. We highly recommend that website. I mean, you know my fondness for it, preservingbibletimes.org. And there's lots of material there that well, explains the stuff in between the lines, the white spaces. There's information there that you may not be aware of. It's not like it adds to Scripture, adds to the Bible, but it tells you what's been there all along with a cultural, historic, linguistic, geographical context, all important stuff. PreservingBibleTimes.org. There are free things there for you, the things you can buy that you can glom onto instantly, streaming and e-books and the like. So do pay them a visit, PreservingBibleTimes.org. Robbie, again, thanks. Special day today. Appreciate it. It's All Souls Day, and now we know why. Thank you.
Joy and a privilege to be with you, Jim and David. Have a wonderful day. Good to be with you on the Broken Road.